Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm very happy to be at Perimeter again after a two-year-long pandemic-induced break. I'm looking forward to discussing with many of you this week. So today I will talk about quantum reference frames for superpositions of spacetimes. And this is work in collaboration with Victoria Kabel, Esteban Castro-Ruiz, and Czaslaw Brückner. And in this talk, I'll go through, on the one hand, some work that appeared on the archive back in December called Falling Through Masses in Superposition, Quantum Reference Frames for Indefinite Metrics. And then I'll also talk about some more recent results that we've had on extended symmetries of the Klein-Gordon field. And we're hoping to put that on the archive in the coming weeks. All right, so let's start by considering a massive object that sources a gravitational field, such as our planet Earth. And let's consider the peculiar situation where this mass is put in a quantum superposition of being at two distinct locations. What would the gravitational field of such a mass look like? Although there are different approaches to quantum gravity, some of which even attempt to answer this question, there doesn't seem to be an unambiguous answer to this question. If we put a probe particle in the vicinity of such a massive superposition, how would it behave? How would its trajectory freely falling in this gravitational field look like? To answer this question, we want to use the formalism of quantum reference frames. So instead of guessing or making specific assumptions about the nature of the gravitational field sourced by such a massive superposition, we want to apply a little trick, which is instead of viewing the situation as you can see it here on the left, we want to view it as depicted here on the right. So what we've done here is we move from the frame of the probe particle or of some distant observer that views this mass in superposition to the frame of the mass itself, in which, of course, the mass is localized. And as a consequence, the probe particle and any other previously localized system will be found in a quantum superposition. So these two situations are considered physically equivalent. But the nice thing about the description on the right is that the system, the massive object that sources the gravitational field, is actually localized in one single position. So in the frame on the right-hand side, we do have known physics, well-established theories that tell us how the probe particle will behave. And in fact, it will fall in a superposition of geodesics towards the location of the mass. If we now go back to the original frame after time evolution, we find that thus, the probe particle will fall in a superposition of geodesics towards the respective locations of the mass in superposition. Okay, so this is a short introductory story, and we will go into details later of what assumptions go into here and what else we can predict. But let me first give you a brief overview of what we'll see in this talk. So in the first part, I'll be talking about this first paper that I mentioned, Falling Through Masses in Superposition. We'll start with a brief recap of the most important notions of quantum reference frames, which we'll then use later on. And then I'll present to you the main assumption that we make upon which the rest of the entire work relies, which is a generalized principle of covariance. We'll then be using this principle to make concrete predictions, such as the motion of a test particle, but also the time dilation experienced by a clock in the vicinity of such a massive superposition. And then I'll show you in which ways we can generalize this result beyond the very simple case that we consider in this talk today. Then in the second part, I'll be talking about extended symmetries of the Klein-Gordon field in superpositions of spacetimes. So we'll first have a look at the classical symmetries of the Klein-Gordon field in an expanding universe. I'll then show you what quantum conformal transformations are and what they can do. And then in the end, we even apply this to a concrete physical phenomenon in curved spacetime, which is cosmological particle production. And then I want to wrap up at the end with a brief comment about the kind of overarching strategy that we're able to identify, which are extended symmetry principles and how to use them. All right, so let's start with a brief intro or recap into quantum reference frames, although I assume that many of you are very familiar with this. So here we consider three different particles, C, A, and B, that are localized on a real line, and we want to describe their positions. And of course, we know that we can choose whatever classical coordinate system that we want. So if we happen to choose one whose origin coincides with the position of particle C, then the position that we assign to A and B are xA and xB. And if I happen to choose a classical coordinate system whose origin coincides with the position of particle A, then particle C and B are going to be at minus xA and xB minus xA respectively. All right, well, we're talking about quantum reference frames, so we need to introduce quantum states for the positions of these particles. Good. So now if you want to find out how we can, we want to talk about this quantum state here on the left, which I denote with a superscript C, just to indicate that this is a state that gives the description of the position of these three particles relative to system C. That means system C is in the origin of this coordinate system and viewing the other particles. So this quantum state lives in this Hilbert space right here, which is also denoted by a superscript C. On the right-hand side, if I choose the coordinate system that coincides with the position, or whose origin coincides with the position of particle A, I have the quantum state right here, and it lives in an isomorphic Hilbert space that also is labeled by a superscript A. And now if I want to find out how I can actually get from the description on the left-hand side to the one on the right-hand side, I can realize on the one hand that I can get from the position of particle B in that coordinate system to the other one simply by applying the conventional translation operator of textbook quantum mechanics, where I translate the position of particle B by minus xA. I can manage to map the other two states of the old and the new reference frame by applying the so-called parity swap operator. What this operator does is it takes the position of particle A and reflects it about the origin, and then it swaps the labels of the two. This is kind of a special operator, but it makes sure that in the new reference frame, this system is now at the origin and the other one, such that the relative distances are kept correctly. And if I compose these two actions, I get a translation operator together with a parity swap, which makes sure that these states are mapped correctly. So this is very classical. I've simply put cats around the positions. I can also generalize this for any state of a third system B. So I can have some sort of wave packet, some amplitude, and I can translate this correctly. But now comes the more interesting scenario, which was, among others, considered by Flaminia, Esteban, and Czaslaw in their paper from 2018. And they asked the question, what happens if I actually change from one reference frame of, for instance, particle C, into the frame of a particle that isn't localized in the original reference frame? So what does it mean to jump on a particle that is in itself in a superposition? And what they realized is that we can use linearity of quantum mechanics. So we can apply the very same translation operator, but we do it coherently in each branch. So in the branch in which particle A is a bit closer to particle C, we will see that also here particle A will be closer to the orange one. The same holds true for any third system. And then in the other branch in which particle A is at position xA2, so a bit further away from C, we will also find that particle C will be further away from particle A. So the important property of such a transformation is that the relative degrees of freedom, in this case, the relative distances, are kept invariant. So then I get here the quantum state of these three systems relative to the quantum reference frame C. And on the right-hand side, I have the quantum state relative to system A. And I can see that I can go from left to right by just slightly modifying this translation operator. In fact, I have to replace the parameter xA, or actually minus xA, by the position operator. And if I do that, and I apply this position operator, this quantum translation operator onto this state, it will pick out the position of the new reference frame in each branch and perform the correct translation and the correct parity swap. And this gives me a quantum controlled translation operator. So again, this is a result found by Giacomini, Castrovois, and Bruckner. And this is essentially all you need to understand what will be happening on the next few slides. There has been, of course, a lot more work in the meantime on quantum reference frames, but we won't need any of the technicalities of these works. All right, so let's go back to the situation that I showed you at the very beginning. So on the one hand, we have this massive superposition together with a probe particle that is localized. And on the right-hand side, we we have the massive object being localized and the proparticle in a superposition. And I told you at the very beginning that we consider these two situations to be equivalent. So there is no preferred reference frame. What is happening here is that on the left-hand side, I choose to describe the situation in the frame of this proparticle or in the frame of some distant observer. And on the right-hand side, I choose to describe it in the reference frame of the mass. The important thing here is that we assume that the physical laws retain their same form independent of which description I choose. Essentially, we assume that any relational observable that I could measure is the same in these both frames. And the principle that encodes this assumption is what we call the generalized principle of covariance. So instead of assuming that physical laws retain their form under classical coordinate transformation, here we assume that they retain their form under quantum coordinate transformations, so superpositions of classical ones. This is the pillar assumption upon which our work relies. So any derivations or results that follow now make this assumption. And the reason we were looking for such a principle in the first place is that, in fact, we want to remain agnostic at first about the nature of the gravitational field that is sourced by such a massive superposition. There are, of course, approaches to quantum gravity which immediately... Yes?
There's a question by Ding, if you want.
Yeah?
Take it.
Sure.
Yes, since you mentioned that this principle is quite important, I'd like to ask a clarifying question. So suppose I think of QFT or quantum mechanics defined by Lagrangian density, the dynamical law is encoded in that density. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to apply your principle to this dynamical law?
Right, so I haven't really made clear yet within which realm of applicability we apply this principle. So of course, this is stated very generally, but we will see in the applications right after this slide in which approximations that we work. So in fact, we're not going into the high energy limit of QFT in this part of the talk yet. So maybe we can go back to this once I've clarified what the kind of realm of applicability is.
So you're telling me you have a principle That doesn't apply always. Like the high energy element of even QFT on classical space-time, it's not applicable. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that this principle could maybe hold in other realms, but we've really technically made this concrete in specific realms. So I'll be talking about the approximations. We'll be talking about particles, the semi-classical approximation of trajectories, and so on. So I think the hope is that this generalized principle of covariance will definitely hold beyond the approximations that we've made, but we haven't formalized it in any of these realms.
Perhaps I should come back after you tell me.
Maybe one thing that I can say is that, of course, there will be some observables that I could potentially directly measure that would be able to differentiate between these two situations. But since we're in the spirit of quantum reference frames here, we're really looking at relational observables. So we're looking at relative degrees of freedom. For instance, the trajectory of this proparticle. I will later introduce an abstract reference frame that is kind of observing this situation. And then relative to this observer, we won't be able to differentiate any of this. But maybe let me go on, and then we can come back to how general these assumptions are later on. All right. So I was explaining why we were even looking for such a principle, such a relatively big assumption. And that is that we didn't want to make any assumptions about the nature of the gravitational field. There are specific approaches to quantum gravity that from the start would assume that such a massive object in superposition simply sources a gravitational field in superposition. And then from that, you can go on and make predictions, but that is not something that we wanted to do. We wanted to actively not write down a metric state in superposition, but try to find a kind of proof of principle argument that allows us to circumvent ever writing down this metric state. And in return, this is the principle that you have to assume. Right. So let us see what this principle allows us to concretely predict. The first application that we look at is the motion of a test particle. So you can see in subfigure one, we have three systems in total. First, I have some reference system R. This could be a distant observer looking at the massive object M in superposition and a probe system S. Importantly, we're assuming that this probe system is not back reacting, so it's not sourcing a gravitational field on its own. And the other thing is that this reference frame R has to be, well, it's also not back reacting, and it has to be far enough away from this massive superposition as to not be gravitationally attracted significantly during the duration of this experiment, such that it can always serve as a good reference frame for the coordinate distances between the other two systems. Okay, so if I write down the quantum state relative to such a reference system R, I can see it will itself be in the origin. I will have a superposition state assigned to the massive object, and at first my probe particle is localized in one position. I will then apply the quantum control translation operator that we saw two slides ago. And what I will find is that the massive object will become definite. We will actually be able to find it in the origin. And since we're coherently translating the other objects, we will find that both the probe system and the reference frame will both be in a superposition, and they will actually become entangled with one another. This is kind of a standard property of these quantum control translation operators. Okay, so after applying this quantum reference frame operator, we're now in a frame in which the massive object is localized. So now there is known physics that we can use in order to predict the time evolution of this probe system. What we use to do that is, on the one hand, and here is the first important assumption that comes in, is that we use the semi-classical approximation to describe the trajectory of this probe system. So we're using the geodesic equation to compute for each given initial position where the probe particle will go. And on the other hand, we will have to compute the relative quantum phase that is accumulated by the probe particle in each branch of the superposition. So what we find in the end is that in this frame in which the mass is localized, the probe particle will move in a superposition of such geodesics, accumulating a quantum phase, towards the position of the mass. And it will be moving in a superposition simply because it started in a superposition of initial positions. Okay. And now, given this time-evolved state in the frame of the mass, we can apply the inverse quantum reference frame transformation to go back to the original frame. And what we see is that the probe will have accumulated a quantum phase, and over the course of time, it will have fallen in a superposition of geodesics towards the respective locations of the mass, and it will have become entangled with the position of the mass. So these are three computational steps in a sequence. But what can we actually conclude from this? Under the assumption that going from subfigure 1 to subfigure 2, which is a quantum reference frame change, we didn't change the physics. So that is really using this generalized principle of covariance. And using the same principle going back from 3 to 4, we can actually assume that things that we infer on the right-hand side in the frame of the mass will still hold true on the left-hand side in the frame in which the mass is in a superposition. So in order to use these predictions that we found and really conclude that this is the time evolution going from 1 to 4 directly, we have to assume this generalized principle of covariance together with well-established theories of physics, where here we used essentially Newtonian gravity and quantum mechanics. Now let us compare these concrete predictions that we got with other approaches to this problem. So just as a recap, if you're ready to use this generalized principle of covariance, you find that in the frame in which the massive object is in a superposition and the probe particle happens to be exactly in the middle of these two, you will find a superposition of trajectories of the particle going towards the left and the right. And in the other frame in which the mass is localized, you also have a superposition of trajectories. Okay. Now let us look at what something like a gravitational collapse model would say in this situation. In the upper subfigure, in the frame in which there is a massive superposition, such a model would say that there is actually a collapse mechanism happening. So just like the flip of a coin, the mass will either collapse toward the right position or towards the left position. So thus we get a trajectory of the probe particle falling either through the right or to the left. In the other frame in which the mass is localized, there is no massive superposition, so there's no collapse mechanism happening. And in that case, the probe particle will still fall in a superposition of trajectories. So we see that what we can say is that the predictions in these two frames of how the probe particle would behave do not coincide. If we go or use an approach such as semi-classical gravity, which takes the energy momentum tensor in the Einstein equations and it takes the expectation value of it, then we see that in the upper subfigure, taking an equally weighted superposition of the mass and putting the probe particle exactly in the middle, the probe particle won't feel any gravitational pull towards the left or the right. So this is a model that predicts that the probe particle will simply stay stationary where it is. Whereas in the other frame, in which the mass is localized, there will be superposition of trajectories of the probe particle falling towards the mass. So again, the predictions of how the particle behaves won't be the same in the two frames. I'm not saying anything against or for certain approaches, but if it is important to you that there is no preferred reference frame, that physics looks the same independent of which of these frames you choose, then maybe you should go for something like a principle of generalized covariance, but also linearized quantum gravity will actually make the same predictions as we do. We're simply using different assumptions, but in the end, both approaches would predict that the behavior is the same in all frames. Okay. Now let's go to another application of this principle, where instead of some probe system S, we take a quantum clock. And we're actually going to fix this quantum clock C at its position so it won't be freely falling. I can again write down the quantum state in the reference frame of R. So I see that the mass is in a superposition, the quantum clock is at a specific factorized out location. And in addition, I have an internal degree of freedom. So I take this quantum clock to be characterized by two different energy levels, E0 and E1. And I have an internal degree of freedom, which kind of oscillates between these two energy levels. So the probability upon measuring it will oscillate with a specific frequency. Okay, so when I go now to the reference frame of the mass, I apply again this quantum reference frame change. I end up in the frame of the mass. I see that my reference system and my clock, their position will have become entangled, but nothing happened to this internal degree of freedom because it's not affected by this transformation. So let us take this internal degree of freedom to be an equally weighted superposition of the zero state and the one state. Now let's see what happens under time evolution. So letting this clock now evolve in the classical gravitational field sourced by this massive object, we can compute its the relative phase that it will acquire in each of the branches separately. And we can compute the state that is assigned to this internal degree of freedom, computing the proper time in each branch of the clock. And thus, we compute the time evolution using this internal Hamiltonian E0, 0, 0 plus E1, 1, 1. And what we find in the end is that we have the situation depicted in subfigure 3, which is a quantum clock in a superposition of positions. So in the one branch, the clock is a bit closer to the massive object, and it will actually tick a bit slower. And in the other branch, in which it is a bit further away from the mass, it will tick a bit faster. And now we apply the inverse quantum reference frame change to go back to the original frame in which the mass is in a superposition. And what we find then is that, again, the position of the clock will factorize out. This is what we wanted. And we see that the clock has accumulated a relative phase and that its state has become entangled with the position of the mass. So we see there is a localized quantum clock whose ticking rate is in a superposition of two different values. And while the situation in number 3 has been tested experimentally, and this is nothing too surprising, we view the situation in subfigure 4 as an actual trace that there is some quantum notion in the gravitational field that is affecting this quantum clock, because the clock itself is localized in it's traveling on one single world line. And still we can observe that the ticking rate is in a superposition. So this has to have something to do with the gravitational field in which it's residing. Okay, we plugged in some numbers into this thought experiment just to see how impossible or feasible it is. We assumed that we can put a mass of the order of the Planck mass in a superposition, approximately 5 micrometers apart. And we assume that we can hold this superposition for about 1 second. And what we see is that there will be a proper time difference between these two branches of the superposition of about 10 to the minus 32 seconds. And while this is a really short proper time or small proper time difference, maybe keep in mind that the best clocks nowadays can measure time differences up to 10 to the minus 20 seconds, it's still not an unbelievably small number. We're orders of magnitude below the Planck time. And with, well, we're hoping that maybe within the next few decades, we can get closer to such orders of magnitude, or of course, design better and more sensitive experiments. All right. I also promised you at the start that we would actually be able to generalize beyond this very simple case of having one mass in superposition. And in fact, we can generalize to any arbitrary number of masses in superposition or any actually continuous mass density. And now, of course, arises the question, can we always find a reference frame in which the space-time metric becomes definite? And the simple answer to this question is no. And I want to explain why. So take the Einstein field equations right here, where on the left-hand side, you have the metric tensor G mu nu, and on the right-hand side, you have the energy momentum tensor T mu nu. And while the Einstein equations in their totality are invariant under the application of any coordinate change, any diffeomorphism, I explained before that here we really want to make a point of staying agnostic about the metric tensor sourced by a massive configuration in superposition. So in fact, we are not really allowed to touch the left-hand side of these equations because we're not going to talk about the metric tensor explicitly. Okay, so if we now consider which superpositions we can actually treat with this argument, for instance, if you take this configuration down here, what we would have to do to map this configuration into one in which the mass configuration is definite is that we would have to squeeze the distance between the blue and the red mass a bit in order to be able to map it onto the other one. However, such a coordinate transformation that involves squeezing will transform the energy momentum tensor T mu nu in a non-trivial way. If you remember how tensors transform, they will actually be prefactors in front of it. And taking the Einstein equations in their totality, that doesn't really matter because these prefactors will factorize out, you get a new metric tensor and everything is fine. However, if you don't allow yourself access to the left-hand side of these equations, well, then you're only allowed to perform coordinate changes that leave G mu nu and T mu nu individually invariant. So this is a restriction that we kind of imposed upon ourselves simply because we don't want to talk about the metric tensor, not necessarily a fundamental thing. However, what are these transformations that leave T mu nu individually invariant? Transformations like that are in fact global translations or global rotations. We have this kind of fancy expression of relative coordinate distance preserving transformations. The reason we're considering those is, or why we're calling it like this, is that we can treat configurations and superpositions like this, where the relative coordinate distances between any pair of masses is the same among or across the entire superposition. So if we have a superposition state like this, describing the mass configuration, then I'm able to globally rotate and globally translate, and then I can match the mass configurations across the different branches. I now have a massive configuration that is definite and sourcing a classical gravitational field. As a consequence, any other systems that were previously localized will be in a superposition. Okay, now some people are quick to say that this renders any situation we can treat completely trivial, since if we have mass configurations related by such transformations in superposition, it means that the metric tensors or the metrics sourced by these configurations are diffeomorphically equivalent. So a true gravity person would say, well, this is simply the same space-time, you're just putting it in a weird superposition, but it's the same thing. And I want to argue against that simply because we have other objects present in the vicinity of this mass configuration. So if I had a completely empty universe and I just had this massive configuration in superposition, and there would be nothing to tell whether there is a superposition or not, no pro particle whatsoever, then I would agree with you. However, as soon as I add a point particle or I add some sort of quantum field, and I then apply a diffeomorphism on the configuration in the one branch, then this diffeomorphism will also affect any other particle, any other field present there. And thus, the superposition that was previously in the massive configuration will simply be shifted towards any other system that is there. So you won't be able to get rid of it, and this is why we consider these to be genuine superpositions of spacetime. Okay, this was just a brief comment about why this is still an interesting situation. And then it's actually very straightforward to also apply this argument that I showed to you to these general massive configurations. I will not bore you with the details of this of the specific form of this quantum reference frame operator, because it's quite tedious to work it out, but it simply consists of a composition of a lot of reflections, rotations, and translations. But we can go through the calculations and do the very same thing. We change to the reference frame in which the massive configuration becomes definite, sources a classical field, compute the trajectory of any probe system that we have, and then go back with an inverse quantum reference frame change, and then we find that any probe system will become entangled with the massive configurations and move in a superposition of geodesics. Okay, so this brings me to the summary of the first part of this talk. We have found concrete predictions that are based on an extended symmetry principle, namely this generalized principle of covariance, while staying agnostic about the nature of the gravitational field sourced by a mass in superposition. We find that a probe particle will move in a superposition of geodesics and become entangled with the mass. And we also found that a quantum clock will tick in a superposition of proper times and become entangled with the mass. We're hoping that experimental tests in the future might be able to corroborate this principle of generalized covariance. And we were hoping to provide an independent argument for the quantum nature of the gravitational field sourced by a mass in superposition without ever having to assume it in the first place. All right, since this wraps up the first part of this talk, I think this is maybe a good moment to take any questions, in case there are any.
Yeah, there's a question by Ding.
Mm-hmm. Would you say at this stage you already mentioned what the approximations are you're taking?
Right. So in this case, we considered quantum particles. So we're not yet at the level of fields in this part. Quantum particles whose trajectory I can compute using the semi-classical approximation. So in the end, I use quantum particles. And the other thing that I assume is that the superposition of the massive object is also a semi-classical superposition state. So it was the massive object being in a superposition, but in each branch separately, I assumed that there was some position xm1, for instance. So if you kind of want to draw this square of different realms of applicability, here we're really in the semi-classical approximation for the massive object, and we're also using essentially quantum mechanics. So although I do believe that this principle should extend towards the realm of quantum field theory, this is not something that we were able to concretely and technically verify. So I'm not going to go as far as taking a bet on that, but I do feel like this should extend.
Okay, I guess maybe after your talk, I'd like to come back to this point because I have the opposite belief. Mm-hmm. Let me stop.
Yes. So you have this restriction to global translations and rotations, but what does this mean? Do you have in mind a flat background spacetime to which you can in which coordinates are you talking about, or do you need some?
Yes. So what
field that generating the translation or something like this?
So you don't have to necessarily view this transformation as an active one where you really do something to the masses. It means that you can find a coordinate system in one of the branches that is different from the coordinate system in the other one, such that when you combine the two, the massive configuration is kind of in the same position. That is what it means to have this quantum coordinate change. So you can change the coordinate system in different ways in the different branches of the superposition. That doesn't mean you have to assume any background field at all, but you're looking at the relative coordinate distances between the systems and trying to map those. So we're really talking about coordinate changes. And from the start, when you write down the state that you're considering, you're already choosing a coordinate system, which is defined relative to this distant reference frame R. So if you look at the more general case of having n masses, this reference system really has to give you these two different axes and an origin, and it will establish a coordinate system in which this first state that I wrote down even has meaning. And then you apply a quantum coordinate change.
That has the same relative.
Right, and then because we're only applying global rigid translations and rotations, this makes sure that the relative distances between any objects will stay the same.
So you need I don't remember the words for this in differential geometry, a single chart or something like this, right? For example, what would be a global translation for a Schwarzschild in the global coordinates? A rotation, I see, but translation.
Well, you would, if you assume some sort of point particle, you would translate it by a coordinate change to another position. So you would perform a global coordinate change. It's not about local.
But spherical coordinates. And
you can represent the Schwarzschild metric in the different sets of coordinates, right?
Cartesian coordinates.
Yeah. You can choose any type of coordinates too.
And then I have to have a map that maps all points that they have constant difference of coordinates. And I just do that.
Yeah. I would guess so, right?
Yes.
So it would be kind of crazy. Well, it would give a weird result, maybe.
Okay. Yes. Well, since it's coordinate changes, it also depends which specific coordinates you start with. But in the end, the restriction to the transformations that we allow for really has to do with this argument that the energy momentum tensor has to remain invariant itself in coordinates. So whatever coordinates you choose, this might change how you would express the coordinate change that you allow for, but it will be the same transformations that will be allowed independent of what coordinates you choose.
Right. So say I just subtract the radiuses.
Exactly, for example.
The difference of radius and angles has to be constant.
Yes. I mean, it will, of course, be quite ugly if you take Schwarzschild.
Okay.
Good. So then maybe we go on to the second part. So in case I lost any of you in the last half hour, now is the time to jump back on the train. We'll be talking about extended symmetries of the Klein-Gordon field in superpositions of spacetimes. So again, let us go out into the universe, this time filled with galaxies, stars, and planets. And as we know, our universe is in a phase right now in which it is undergoing an accelerated expansion at a certain Hubble constant. So that means that stars, planets, and galaxies are moving away from us. And now imagine, just for a moment and just for the argument, that we live in a universe that is undergoing an accelerated expansion in a superposition of different rates. And then we can ask the questions, how would fields and particles behave in such a world? Okay, now the reason we're asking such a question is the following. In the end, the goal of this sort of research program is to build both intuition and techniques to deal with a true quantum metric, including fuzziness of space-time. What we've done so far is we've considered superpositions of diffeomorphic metrics. And in fact, we were even restricted to superpositions of metrics that were related by these relative coordinate distance preserving transformations. So this is quite a restriction what we've had in part one. And additionally, we've considered semi-classical states of particles in the vicinity of a gravitational source. And now we want to go beyond this. The first way in which we go beyond what we've done so far is that we're no longer just going to be considering coordinate transformations, diffeomorphisms, to map different metrics onto one another. Here we actually go to conformal transformations. And the connection to the previous slide with the expanding universe is that such an expanding universe is described by an FLRW metric. And an FLRW metric can be specified by its Hubble constant. And if you want to relate two such metrics that have different Hubble constants, you can do that by a conformal transformation. A conformal transformation is more than a diffeomorphism. So here we really go beyond these coordinate transformations. We will still stay in the semi-classical approximation for the superposition state of the metric. So when I now actually write down a superposition state for the different Gs, I still mean that in each branch separately, I do have a classical metric. And the third point in which we go beyond what we've done so far is that now we really consider quantum fields that inhabit a space-time in superposition. And we're going to go down a similar route as before in terms of finding a transformation that leaves the equations of motions invariant, but that maps the situation to one in which we have a definite space-time metric. Okay, so I hope the motivation for what we're doing now is clear, more or less, because then we can start with the classical symmetries of the Klein-Gordon field. So take a spatially flat FLRW space-time, and the line element of this space-time is given with this expression right here. And then we also take the Klein-Gordon equation in curved space-time. So we have covariant derivatives interacted with the metric tensor here. We have a Klein-Gordon field phi characterized by a mass term m that lives on such a curved space-time and that satisfies this equation. Okay. And now I told you that in the end we want to render the situation or turn the situation into one where the space-time metric is definite. And in fact, FLRW is a conformally flat metric. That means there exists a conformal transformation which can transform G into Minkowski. So this is something that we're looking for now, just out of convenience. We're looking for a transformation which will make the metric or the space-time flat. We're also looking for a transformation of the Klein-Gordon field to another one. And we're looking for a transformation of the mass term. And what we ask is that given that the field phi in space-time G with mass term m satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation, then also in Minkowski, this new field with the new mass parameter will satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, some of you might be very quick to say, well, the Klein-Gordon equation is not conformally invariant, so you won't find any conformal transformations that will do this. In fact, what is done often in the literature is that people introduce such a non-minimal coupling term, and it turns out that this equation is conformally invariant if you choose xi equals 1/6 and a massless Klein-Gordon field. But this is not what we're looking for here. We're really looking for a form invariance under conformal transformations of this equation. But there's no free lunch, so we have to give in somewhere else. And what we're ready to do is to accept that on Minkowski spacetime, the mass term of this Klein-Gordon field will be spacetime dependent. Okay, so now we're looking for a transformation that will leave the form of this Klein-Gordon equation invariant. And it turns out that we found this transformation. On the one hand, as I told you, we want to go from this FLRW metric G to Minkowski. And it's a conformal transformation which takes us there with the conformal factor exponential of minus 2 ht, where h is this Hubble constant that characterizes G. If we want to find the field that satisfies this Klein-Gordon equation in flat space-time, we also perform a conformal transformation. You can see it here in blue. And we find this space-time dependent mass term. In fact, for FLRW, it's only time dependent given by this expression right here. And you can easily convince yourself that this is true simply by plugging in all of these expressions, going through the calculations and seeing that indeed, given that the equation in curved space-time is satisfied, also the one in flat space-time will be satisfied. Okay. We can even map between any two FLRW metrics that are characterized by different Hubble constants h1 and h2. The transformations look a bit more tedious, but it's really the same thing. So we can get a new metric g2 by a conformal transformation. We get the new field phi2 and a new mass parameter m2 simply by applying these transformations. And we summarize these transformations under this curly F. And it turns out that this is not just any transformation. This is, in fact, a group representation. So that is nice because it really shows us that there is a symmetry underlying this. Let's say you have some FLRW metric G1 characterized by a Hubble constant H1, another one with H2, and another one with H3. And now what this means that this is a group representation is that you can really transform around as much as you want. You can go from 1 to 2 to 3, and it composes exactly as you would expect it to compose. So we see here that within the same conformal equivalence class of conformally flat metrics, we can jump around as much as we want. I can go from one FLRW metric with the Klein-Gordon field and the mass term to any other, to Minkowski, and back to another one, and it will all be consistent. If I start with a solution, I will also find solution to the other Klein-Gordon equations. In fact, this is even a bit more general. This doesn't only hold for conformally flat metrics, this holds for any two conformally equivalent metrics. So conformally equivalent metrics are related by such a conformal factor omega. And now if I want that this Klein-Gordon equation is satisfied if and only if the other one is satisfied, then I can also find transformations for this case. I can find the metric tensor, the field, and the mass term for the second case. And again, this will also give me a group representation, so this composes exactly as I want. So this means that given any set of metrics that are conformally related, so that live in the same conformal equivalence class, I can use these transformations to map around these situations. Okay. Let us go one step further by now considering a quantized Klein-Gordon field. I will not go into the details of this too much because it's really straightforward. If you're on a curved spacetime and you have a classical Klein-Gordon field, you can define a pseudo inner product. This allows you to expand your classical field in terms of a complete set of frequency modes that satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. You then promote the coefficients in this expansion to annihilation and creation operators, and you get an expansion of your quantum field. This allows you, for instance, to define a vacuum state on curved spacetime. You can do the same thing on Minkowski. You again define a pseudo inner product. You have an expansion of the Klein-Gordon field. You promote these coefficients to annihilation and creation operators. You also get an expansion of your quantum field, and you get a vacuum state on Minkowski. Good. So what we've just seen is that on the left-hand side, we have the situation of a curved spacetime described by an FLRW metric, for instance, and a Klein-Gordon field on it, described by some mass parameter m. And on the right-hand side, we have Minkowski spacetime and a Klein-Gordon field living on it, characterized by a spacetime-dependent mass term. And since the equation of motion is invariant under the transformation that we found, and also forms a group representation, we can truly say that this is a symmetry that we found. And now we do the usual thing that quantum reference frame people do, which is take everything to the quantum level and consider spacetimes in superposition. So what we have on the left-hand side now is different curved spacetimes in superposition, but importantly, these are not related by diffeomorphisms. There is no coordinate change whatsoever which will ever take you from any of these spacetimes to the other ones. You really need to go beyond them and apply these conformal transformations that we found. Okay, so let us consider this quantum state that I wrote here at the bottom. Let's start maybe with this one, which is the state relative to m. What that means is that the quantum state of the mass parameter that I assign to this Klein-Gordon field factorizes out. There's simply one that I consider. On the other hand, I do have this superposition state for the spacetime metric, where I really want to point out this is a semi-classical state of superposition state, so each of these metrics is classical in each branch. And then I also have the Klein-Gordon field, which is a solution to whatever metric we're considering in the respective branches. In the other frame, which I label with this superscript G, the quantum state that we assign to the space-time factorizes out. So this could, for instance, be Minkowski. And as a consequence, now I find a superposition of different space-time dependent mass parameters. And in each branch, I get a different field living on that. Are there any questions on this so far?
Sorry, I didn't understand. So on the left-hand side, you have a superposition of different spacetimes, but the mass term factors out. And on the right-hand side, instead you have a definite metric,
yes,
a superposition of fields on,
yes,
on
exactly,
a well-defined space.
Yes. To be very precise, we actually always have a superposition of fields, uh-huh, because in each branch you have to solve for the Klein-Gordon equation. And because here you have a superposition of metrics, there will actually be a different solution in each branch. And here, because you have a different mass parameter, you will also have a different solution in each branch. So interestingly, the field is actually always entangled with one or the other system. You will never get rid of this. But what we focus on is that in the one frame, you're really in the frame relative to which the mass parameter will factorize out. So it's really an abstract quantum reference frame in this case. We're no longer talking about jumping into one system or another. And in this frame, the space-time metric.
So what you're drawing there are the fields, not the space-time.
Yes, exactly. So I have kind of a curved space-time and the field living on it. And you can see that, I mean, I'm not sure if you can see it, but they're supposed to be stretched or squeezed. Good. Any other questions?
You said something about FRW, but is it more general than just FRW, which is homogeneous? It's like any conformally.
Exactly. So the first step of generalization was that you could go to any conformally flat metric. So that also includes de Sitter, FLRW, Minkowski, all of that. So within that equivalence class of all the metrics that are related by conformal transformations to flat spacetime, I can go between those. But then there also, I can take any other metric and see where can I get with a conformal transformation. And this establishes an equivalence class. And in fact, I can map between all of those. And I get the other like respective solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. It depends on whether that's a case that you're interested in. And I will mainly talk about FLRW, conformally flat, and Minkowski here, because Minkowski is just something that we understand quite well. But yeah, it's quite general. Any other questions? Okay, good. So there's been a lot of work generally on superpositions of spacetimes, and people have considered one or the other situation, but we really wanted to make sure not just to look at this idea, but we wanted to concretely and explicitly construct an operator which takes us from this situation to this one. So we've now found a symmetry on the classical level. We took this symmetry to the quantum level, assuming that this is also kind of the same physical situation, at least in terms of relational observables, even if we have quantum superpositions of these spacetimes. But now we want to really find an operator that maps this one state to this other state. And we find a fancy name for this, which is a quantum conformal operator, but it really just does what I just said. So it takes a state living in this Hilbert space labeled with a superscript M, two states in a Hilbert space labeled with superscript G. So these superscripts simply mean that there live in this Hilbert space, there are quantum states where either the state assigned to the mass or the state assigned to the metric factorizes out. That's all it means. And now I want to find such an operator. And I can use this symmetry that I found and this group representation F that we found in order to define the action of this operator on the basis states. So for any basis state in which I have Gi, M squared, and phi, which is a solution to the respective Klein-Gordon equation, I will map it onto the state on the right-hand side. So I will apply these representations respectively. And for instance here, if I choose the right transformations, this could give me Minkowski space. Okay. So we're able to write down this operator and really establish this equivalence. And now I promised you at the very beginning that we would actually look at a physical phenomenon and try to understand what happens if we apply the symmetry and also what happens in a superposition of spacetimes. And the phenomenon that we will look at is cosmological particle production. So people in cosmology can, for instance, consider the scenario right here. What you see in this figure is the so-called scale factor of the FLRW metric. What that means is that the factor that conformally relates Minkowski flat spacetime to the curved one is given by this function right here. What we can see is that there are two asymptotic regions and that the scale factor, so the rate with which the universe expands, changes over time. And it's quite important that we have these asymptotic regions because it allows us to use some of the QFT methods. So what people do is they call the first region at the start the in region, and they call the other asymptotic region at the end the out region. And then they define creation and annihilation operators in these asymptotic regions. They call the creation and annihilation operators in the in region at the start A and A dagger, and the ones at the end, B and B dagger. And these creation annihilation operators are not the same. They're not trivially related. They're related by a so-called Bogoliubov transformation. We don't need to understand what these coefficients mean whatsoever. It's just important that they're not the same. As a consequence, for instance, also the vacuum states, which are defined as when I apply the annihilation operator onto it, it will vanish, are also not going to be the same. And therefore, what we will actually observe is that going from the in region to the out region, there will be an expected number of particles produced. So if I let the number operator defined in the out region act on the vacuum in the in region, it gives me the expected number of particles, which is just the sum over the modes of the second Bogoliubov coefficient module squared. Okay, so there's some number of particles being produced. What we now asked is, what does this symmetry of the Klein-Gordon field that we found tell us about this phenomenon in other spacetimes? And particularly, we wanted to go to Minkowski spacetime, because usually in flat spacetime, you do not observe particle production. However, we don't have completely normal Minkowski spacetime. We have a Klein-Gordon field with a spacetime-dependent mass term on a Minkowski spacetime. And the way you can understand this mass term in a different way, if you don't really like spacetime-dependent masses, is that, for instance, this could be some sort of additional potential that influences the Klein-Gordon field. And if we assume such a scale factor like here on the left, then the corresponding time or the functional dependence of this mass parameter will look like this. So both in curved spacetime and in Minkowski, we will observe these asymptotic regions, once for the scale factor, once for the mass parameter. And what you can easily find once you go through the calculations is that, in fact, the creation annihilation operators in the asymptotic in region are the same in FLRW than they are in Minkowski. And they're also the same in the out region. So as a consequence, the vacuum states in the in region in curved spacetime corresponds to the vacuum state in Minkowski, and the same holds for the out region. Okay, these are technical details. What can we conclude from that? What can you understand on a physical level? In fact, if you go through this calculation and you compare the number of particles produced in curved spacetime with the one in Minkowski spacetime, you find that they're the same. So we do have particle production in a Minkowski spacetime simply because the Klein-Gordon field is characterized by a mass term that is spacetime dependent. And that could potentially be understood as some additional potential if you want that. So this brings me to the summary of part two. The first thing that we were able to show is that there seems to be some sort of equivalence of frame descriptions that are based on an extended symmetry principle, namely invariance under quantum conformal transformations. On the one hand, we have a quantized massive Klein-Gordon field living on a superposition of conformally related metrics. And in the other frame, we have a quantized massive Klein-Gordon field in a superposition of different spacetime-dependent masses inhabiting a definite Minkowski spacetime. The motivation for this, for these results and for this work is that we hope to provide a deeper intuition of what it means to have quantum fields living on, on geometries in superposition. And we identified a conformally invariant observable, namely the number operator, comparing it in curved spacetime and in Minkowski spacetime, and we imported an actual phenomenon of particle production to Minkowski spacetime. Maybe I will just finish with the brief comment that I wanted to make on extended symmetry principles and then go to questions. So the general strategy that we were able to identify over the course of this work is useful in order to tackle superpositions of spacetimes, and it consists of two steps. The first step is to restrict to a subtheory. In this case, it was the quantum field theory of a massive Klein-Gordon field. And the second step is to allow for transformations of quantities that are usually left untouched. So in this case, this would be the mass term, which usually is not affected by a transformation. So often in the context of quantum gravity research, people focus on the symmetries of the most general theories there are. So we have the diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity, we have the gauge symmetries of quantum field theory. This is why people usually restrict to transformations of this kind. What we do here is we do not take the full generality of Einstein's equations and the diffeomorphism invariants, etc. We restrict the range of application by considering a Klein-Gordon field that is massive in some curved spacetime. But we enlarge the set of allowed transformations that leave the equations of motions invariant. That's the first step. The second step is that we extend the symmetry that we find to the quantum level and assume that linearity of quantum theory holds, and that we can really have the symmetry in each branch of the superposition. And we hope that this can enhance our understanding of scenarios that are at the intersection of quantum physics and gravity without requiring a full theory of quantum gravity. Okay. So what do we hope for in future work? Well, the first thing is we would also like to go beyond quantum conformal transformations, of course. And the idea is to potentially exploit this strategy that is based on extended symmetry principles. Another important step that is needed is to take into account the true quantum fuzziness of spacetime. So to really go beyond the semi-classical approximation. In the first part of this talk, I told you that we considered these massive objects in superposition, but we used the semi-classical approximation in this superposition state. And similarly, we also considered a semi-classical superposition state assigned to the metric. And one possible way to go beyond that and to actually take into account quantum fuzziness is to extend and apply the framework of quantum reference frames to quantum fields so that you can really take on the perspective of a quantum field. And then in the end, we also hope that to at some point be able to design experimental proposals that test these extended symmetry principles, so the principle, the generalized principle of covariance, and also this invariance under quantum conformal transformations. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention, and I already look forward to any questions or comments that you might have.
Any questions? There's a question by Ding, but maybe somebody else, if you have. Yeah, Tom.
Thanks for the presentation, it's very interesting. So, is it one of the main assumptions, or like the key assumptions, that physical laws retain their form in a quantum coordinate transformation, right?
Yes.
I'm happy to kind of map between the two. I'm reading the first paper by Flaminia et al. Chandler. They showed that, I think, the Hamiltonian changes, right, if you turn to a quantum reference frame. So would this mean that then the laws also change, or is this...
Right, so it depends in the end on what equation of motion you take and what symmetries this equation of motion allows for. Whether it is the geodesic equation or generally the Einstein field equations, or it is the Schrödinger equation, the choice that you take in what equation of motion you want to stay invariant will influence which transformations will be considered as the ones that leave them invariant. So in the case of the Schrödinger transformation, it turned out that actually, they do not leave it invariant if you don't consider this additional term. So it's really an interplay between the equation of motion that you choose and then the symmetry transformations. And when stating this generalized principle of covariance, we're of course very much led by the historical example of the classical principle of covariance, which really is often formulated in the context of the Einstein equations, where you have diffeomorphism invariance and you can apply any coordinate change.
Okay.
Ding?
Thank you. Thanks for the nice talk. However, I'd like to make some comments, maybe to give an alternative view on the questions you dealt with. Slightly negative or very negative. But anyways, I hope it's in the hope of getting closer to the truth. So, in my opinion, the questions you deal with are solved questions, and they are solved by a very simple solution. One could even put it in one line. So the question is, how do we study quantum gravity with matter at a semi-classical level? And the one-line question is simply, we solve for the stationary points of the action given suitable boundary conditions. For example, in the picture, if I have say a large mass in superposition of different places and a probe clock, say. Then we have gravity and matter together. We want to treat it semi-classically. How do we do that? Well, to set up this setting, we impose some boundary conditions. And then we simply solve for the stationary points of the action, which effectively just is solving the classical equation of motion under the boundary condition. However, this is different from classical theory because the boundary conditions can give rise to non-classical configurations. For example, in this case, we would get two classical solutions to the gravity-matter coupled system. And these are the dominating contributions, say, for the gravitational and matter path integral. And that's solved. We have two semi-classical configurations with matter and gravity in superposition. And this is a very general solution. You could have a quantum particle or a quantum field for matter, maybe even strings, as long as you have an action where you can impose boundary conditions on, it's okay to use the solution. And as far as I can see, all the results you presented are limited to a special case of this general solution, which is symmetry reduced subtheories. But that one line solution holds more generally. So the alternative perspective I have is that all the questions you dealt with are solved, and even the questions you mentioned on the outlook slide are solved because this solution holds for beyond symmetry reduced subtheories.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comment, because especially in the second part, I presented very recent results, and I think it's very valuable to get the perspective of people that work in completely different fields. And I think what you just described really, really well is the difference between a top-down and a bottom-up approach. So I completely agree that there are very powerful techniques and tools out there that you can use to relatively straightforwardly answer these questions. I think the goal in the end that we have might be the same in terms of predictions, but what we want to find along the way is really identify which are generally the principles that we want to assume to construct a physical theory. So this is really also a question of how do you construct a physical theory? What are the principles that are important to you? And so yes, we are at the start of this research program in which at this point we're answering maybe questions that seem very trivial or easy to someone that is looking at that from an outside perspective. But I do think that there's value in identifying the fundamental principles that we need in order to maybe go beyond these questions at some point. Of course, the point at which it will get really interesting is still far ahead, but I don't think that a bottom-up and a top-down approach are in that sense contradicting each other, or that one should choose the one or the other in order to get to eventually the same goal. But I do completely appreciate your comment, and I will definitely bring this back to my other collaborators so that we can take this into consideration when analyzing this project.
I guess there are at least 4 points of your comment that I actually disagree about, but we can discuss that in an informal setting.
Yes, I'd like.
And thanks for your appreciation of my comments. And thanks for your reply.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Not sure I'm able to even say what I didn't understand, but
mm-hmm.
It's like you have this idea of equations keeping the same form
mm-hmm.
under coordinate transformations, but then you seem to say that if it changes form by a conformal factor, somehow, what does this mean? Do you still say it keeps the same form because it differs, so it's a different form, but you say now it's the same form? I didn't really understand
mm-hmm.
what this...
Right, so your question concerns this, what a lot of people do in the literature, where they introduce an additional term such that the Klein-Gordon equation becomes conformally invariant. So that before the transformation, you have the conventional Klein-Gordon equation, but then you have to introduce this term such that it really becomes that. And what I meant by form invariance is that before and after performing this transformation, you know what your equation will look like. So whether you start from the curved spacetime, you apply your transformations, and you get the Klein-Gordon equation in Minkowski spacetime, or you were to start from that from the beginning, you would know what your equation would look like. So we kind of need the form invariance in order to be able to start anywhere we want with what we know. We can know the spacetime, we can know the field solving the equation and the mass term. And then whether I start in Minkowski and go in the one direction or I start in curved spacetime and go in the other, it's the same. Whereas if you have suddenly the introduction of a term, sometimes when you perform the transformation, then you always have to start from the one direction, go into the other, but there's no real symmetry that allows you to go back and forth.
But here you have this symmetry.
Here we have it. In the end, it's a trade-off between whether you want this additional term in the Klein-Gordon equation, which is the usual choice in the literature. People are just ready to introduce this xi times r term in the Klein-Gordon equation. And we didn't want to do that, but we had to give in somewhere else. So we were ready to say, well, then the mass parameter in Minkowski will be space-time dependent. So we can kind of absorb this factor that this additional factor that there was into the mass parameter. In the end, it's a choice that you make.
And it's as the mass parameter becomes like a dynamical field.
Exactly. And if you don't like that, then you have to keep going with this addition of the non-linearly coupled extra term.
So yeah, he had examples. So yeah, these like different accelerations. Whereas accelerations would be parameters.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, do you also get them that you kind of like quantizing parameters? In a sense, like you have like a hat on your acceleration operator.
Yes. So I want to be very careful with what we put hats on, because then we would have a very well-defined Hilbert space structure and everything. But in the end, when you write down such a superposition state of the metric, but you're in the case where all of these metrics are conformally related, you might as well label each of the space-time metrics simply by this conformal factor omega. So in the end, especially if you take FLRW, instead of writing ket G1 plus ket G2 plus ket G3, you could also just label these states with the Hubble constant. So in the end, that is a constant, so it's really just L2 of R. You just have a very conventional Hilbert space in which then the quantum state that you assign to the spacetime is just a Hubble constant. And it's important that we're really in the case L2 of R. So in each of these branches, it's just a real parameter that will give you a classical spacetime metric.
Yes, I don't know too much about this, but then I guess you assume that they're somehow like orthogonal, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Is that like a big assumption in the kind of gravitational setting that the different accelerations?
Yes. So this is. Yes, this is exactly the point of going beyond the semi-classical approximation. It goes in this direction. So there's also been this work by Flaminia where she considers superpositions of spacetimes, and she has this very well-stated assumption of physically distinguishable spacetimes are assigned orthogonal quantum states. And in the same sense, also here, if you have a quantum state H1 assigned to FLRW with Hubble constant H1 and H2 for the other one, then of course, yes, we will assume that these are orthogonal states because they're physically distinguishable. Yes.
Okay, so then the generalization is to go to like coherent states.
Exactly, exactly. This is exactly what I mean by this point. And that would mean considering the true, or going towards considering true quantum fuzziness of spacetime.
Okay.
Whereas now we really have classical spacetime plus a classical spacetime plus a classical spacetime.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I guess like, so I guess the conformal transformation assumption is like both, what is it, a technical assumption, or like, so with the full GR case, do you expect that there's something physical, like there'd be some extension of this to the full case where you, I guess you said that you can't map any, so you can't map, well, I guess you could imagine taking any metric, and I guess there's some technical reasons why you have to have a, so you say you have the conformal thing, and
yeah,
then you know that you can map it to a Klein-Gordon
exactly.
or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess as extensions, you could imagine like just adding more terms to the equation with
yes.
arbitrary parameters.
Right. So the other thing you could do is actually just choose a different equation of motion.
Right.
So it's really choosing this equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, and also allowing the mass parameter to change. That specifies which transformations you will be able to perform that will leave this equation of motion invariant. And then if you choose a different one, for instance, the Einstein equations, you will actually be restricted back to diffeomorphisms. But then if you were to choose an kind of, I think what Ding called a reduced symmetry, like a sub-theory, if you reduce that even more, of course, the set of transformations that you can perform is actually going to be enlarged. So it's a trade-off between how general am I, how general is my equation of motion, but then which symmetry transformations are allowed.
So can you also have interactions as well, like within, in principle, if you had like a five?
In principle, yes, this would probably belong on this outlook slide. Especially in concerning the first part of the talk, we're not yet considering, for instance, the masses moving or them interacting with anything or other systems gravitating. So there's loads of directions of possible generalizations there.
Okay, then if there's not any more questions, let's thank Anne-Catherine again.
Thank you.